Before I start, I just wanted to make mention of the fact that that John Miles lost his brother the other day, his older brother, and he's also lost a cousin in the last month. It's been a very difficult time for you, John, and we just want to extend to you our love and our sympathy, and we'll pray that God will help you to stay strong personally, but also for your family during this difficult time. In September 2016, I had to conduct a wedding in a small country town, and so I flew off for the weekend. And on my way home on the Monday morning, I was sitting in the plane next to an American guy, a Texan. And we started talking, and like you do, you sort of start talking pretty generally about things that are happening in the world and in life generally and that sort of thing. Anyway, somehow or other, we got talking about American politics. And in particular, we started talking about Donald Trump. Now, I know very little about American politics, and at that time, I'm talking back now about sort of 18 months ago, I knew even less about Donald Trump. And I just sort of had the idea that he was a bit of a showman, and I didn't really think he was a serious politician, and I just kind of laughed him off. What I didn't realise was that that this guy was a passionate Donald Trump supporter. And so for the next hour, I sort of sat there, and he told me all the reasons why Donald Trump was going to be the next president of the United States. I was pretty sceptical, but I was too polite to actually say anything nasty about the man. But to be honest with you, as I listened to this guy, I became increasingly more intrigued to find out what it was about him. I knew he had a huge ego, but I really wanted to know what his agenda was, what he really wanted to accomplish if he ever did become President of the United States. Well, of course, we now know that 2 months later, Donald Trump did become the President of the United States, which was, I guess, a great surprise to most observers. But you know what? After 18 months, I still can't figure the guy out. And I'm trying to, because I really want to understand whether he's, you know, I know what the media says about him, and, you know, they kind of bag him. But I mean, is he doing a good job? Is his agenda any good? Is America, is the world better because of Donald Trump becoming president? I still don't know the answers to those questions. Well, you might wonder what on earth that's got to do with Matthew chapter 9. But anyway, that's what we're talking about tonight. I want to read these verses because here we have a situation where the disciples of John the Baptist were confused about Jesus. They wanted to know what track Jesus was on, what his agenda was all about, because they were confused. And this is kind of the context for these verses that we're going to look at. It's only four or five verses, but let's read them together from Matthew 9, verses 14 to 17. Then John's disciples came and asked him, "How is it that we and the Pharisees fast often, but your disciples do not fast?" Jesus answered, "How can the guests of the bridegroom mourn while he is with them? The time will come when the bridegroom will be taken away from them, then they will fast. No one sews a patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment, for the patch will pull away from the garment, making the tear worse. Neither do people pour new wine into old wineskins. If they do, the skins will burst. The wine will run out and the wineskins will be ruined. No, they pour new wine into new wineskins, and both are preserved." There were obviously some differences between the disciples of John the Baptist and the disciples of Jesus. And these men, we've got to give them the benefit of the doubt, these men who were disciples of John the Baptist were genuinely wanting to know why it was that these differences existed. Who is this guy, Jesus? What is he on about? Should we take him seriously? Is he the real deal, or is he just like a shooting star who comes and suddenly he's gone? Now, I don't want to infer tonight that there are any real similarities between Donald Trump and Jesus. The link is merely that sometimes public figures can arouse curiosity simply because they're different. And that seems to be the case here. What was the question that John's disciples are asking? Look at verse 14 there. Then John's disciples came and asked him, "How is it that we and the Pharisees fast often, but your disciples do not fast?" We fast. The Pharisees fast. But you and your disciples, they don't fast. I mean, for us today, reading this here, we think, well, this is a pretty minor, even a trivial issue. But what we have to understand is what is actually behind this question that these disciples of John the Baptist are asking. These men were serious Jews, and so were the Pharisees. We know from historical records that the Pharisees actually fasted every Monday and Thursday, twice a week. They fasted. That's how serious they were about fasting. It was fundamental to the way they practiced their Jewish religion. We don't know exactly how often the disciples of John the Baptist fasted, but one thing we do know is that fasting was an important part of their religious life. It's interesting that in the previous couple of verses that Greg took us through last week, what do we find Jesus and his disciples doing? They're having a party. There they were in Matthew's house having a party with, tax collectors and sinners of all people. And so it would seem anyway that Jesus and his disciples had been getting a bit of a reputation for, for having a good time. I'm not sure they were party animals by modern definition, but they enjoyed themselves and they had a good time. Fasting, obviously, wasn't an important part of the routine of Jesus and his disciples. It's interesting to ask ourselves the question, why was it that the Pharisees and the disciples of John actually fasted at all? If we look carefully through the Old Testament, it would seem that the only day of the year that Jews were actually required to fast was the Day of Atonement, one day a year. But somehow or other, over the years, through the traditions that had been accumulated by the Jewish religion, it had got to the point where the Pharisees were very devoutly fasting twice a week. Maybe it was a sign of repentance. Maybe it was just a sort of a sign of their devotion to God. We don't really know. But for whatever reason, this tradition had developed. Maybe they didn't even know why they fasted. They just did it because that was what they were taught to do. Anyway, for whatever reason, it was a religious ritual, like lots and lots of other legal and ceremonial traditions that were part of the Jewish religion in those days. And compared to them, Jesus and his disciples seemed so much freer and so much, probably happier, even though they didn't fast. Maybe these disciples of John were secretly jealous of them. There they are, enjoying themselves, they're having a good time. And here we are, having a very painful, boring old time fasting while these other guys are out partying on. Well, there were two possibilities. Either Jesus and his disciples were being openly sinful and were not true Jews, or else, and this is the other possibility, the track that Jesus was on, the agenda that Jesus was setting, was very, very different from the one that they were on. Well, that was the question It was all about fasting. What is the answer? What was the answer that Jesus gave? Look at verse 15. Jesus answered, "How can the guests of the bridegroom mourn while he is with them? The time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them, then they will fast." This is a very clever answer, which I'm sure Jesus gave them specifically to make them think. What he's saying here, when the wedding feast is on, it is time to party. And what's going on at the moment is the wedding feast. I'm the host of a wedding feast which is happening. Now, you know, they were probably sort of scratching their heads wondering, what on earth is Jesus smoking? Who is the bridegroom in this verse here? Just think about it for a moment. Who's the bridegroom that he's referring to here? It is himself. I'm the bridegroom. The bridegroom is responsible for putting on the wedding feast, the wedding reception. In those days, weddings went for about a week. It was free food and drink for everybody. Come on in if you're a wedding guest and enjoy yourself and party on. This business about fasting has got nothing to do with it. You can imagine going to a wedding feast and the waiter greets you at the door there and says, "What would you like to drink?" So, "I'm sorry, I'm fasting today." That's ridiculous, isn't it? Who would go to a wedding like that? Well, this is the context, but Jesus was prodding them even further by referring to himself as a bridegroom, because in Jewish thinking, reference to a bridegroom basically meant reference to God. You see, if you read the Old Testament carefully, you'll see that many times God refers to himself as the husband of the nation of Israel. He was the bridegroom to his bride, who were the Jewish people. Let me just give you one example. This is Isaiah 62, verse 5. This is just one of many examples. And this is what it says in Isaiah 62, verse 5. "As a young man marries a young woman, so will your builder marry you." That's a reference to God. "As a bridegroom rejoices over his bride, so will your God rejoice over you." God, through the prophet Isaiah, 700 or 800 years before Jesus, is referring to himself as the bridegroom who is marrying his bride and rejoicing over her. And now we have Jesus basically claiming to be the bridegroom. Here we have Jesus referring to himself as the one who is in a special relationship with his people. This is a very big call that Jesus is making here. And I'm sure that those guys that day, those disciples of John the Baptist, would have immediately picked up on what he was saying. Jesus is basically, in a very subtle way, claiming to be God. You guys are worrying about fasting. I just want you to know that I am God, and here I am, and these are my men. And we are introducing a whole new agenda. So Jesus gave those disciples of John the Baptist that day the very best possible reason not to fast. He said, "No, I'm here, and it's time to celebrate." Well, let's have a look then at the next two verses, because Jesus in these two verses goes on to give us an explanation. He explains what's going on. "No one sews a patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment, for the patch will pull away from the garment, making the tear worse. Neither do people pour new wine into old wineskins. If they do, the skins will burst, the wine will run out, and the wineskins will be ruined. No, they pour new wine into new wineskins, and both are preserved." What does Jesus mean here? Well, I want to make a disclaimer right up front. I know almost nothing about sewing. Go and have a talk to Rachel if you want to know about sewing. But I understand this much, that unless a piece of fabric has been pre-shrunk, and especially back in those days where you know the clothing was, where the materials, the fabrics were a bit rougher, that unless this piece of fabric had been pre-shrunk, if you sewed it onto an old garment, a new piece onto an old garment, it would just very quickly pull away. And of course, the tear would be just as bad as it was before. It's a bad move to do that. And I also know very little about fermenting wine, but I do know that in those days, the way that they fermented wine was they put the grape juice into sacks made out of animal skins, and they sewed these animal skins tightly together. And they would pour the grape juice into these wine skins, which were pliable. And over time, as the grape juice fermented and turned into wine, so those sacks made of these animal skins would stretch up. But if you put new wine into an old sack, the old sack had already been stretched, so it wouldn't have enough extra stretchability in it. And so it was only a matter of time before that old skin would rupture, would burst, and you'd lose your wine. What Jesus is saying here is that it is very dangerous to try and mix the new with the old. It just simply doesn't work. So what's he getting at? Well, the old Jewish religion, he's saying here, is like the old worn-out wineskin. And if you put the new wine of the gospel into that old wineskin, well then, it's simply going to turn into a disaster. And what Jesus is saying is that by my coming, I haven't come to renovate the old ways of Moses. I've come to replace them with something totally new. That's in effect what Jesus is saying here. He said, by my coming, I have come to do away with the old system and to replace it with something new, a whole new way of relating to God. The old ways, the ways of the Pharisees, even the ways of the disciples of John the Baptist, was about keeping rules. It was keeping those sort of formal religious regulations like fasting, and observing Sabbaths and making sacrifices and those sorts of things. And what Jesus had come to do was to replace those with something which was much simpler, which was not dependent on what we do to please God, but was all about what God has done for us by sending Jesus himself, who would then take away our sin and make us right with God. About this time 5 years ago, if you can remember back that far, we had a huge amount of rain, and a lot of storm damage was done at that point in time, and lots of parts of Brisbane lost power for quite a while, and we lost power for 40 hours at our place. When the power came back on, the freezer in our fridge just didn't work anymore, which was a big problem. And so I very quickly got on to the insurance company. I said, our fridge has blown up and it's not working. Anyway, I guess they were getting so many phone calls at the insurance companies at this time that they didn't have time to send somebody out to check me to see whether I was telling the truth or not. But they said, how old is it? I said, 16 years old. And they said, well, if we send someone to fix it, they'll have to replace the gas in it. It's going to be a very expensive job. Just go and buy yourself a new fridge. I thought that was a pretty good deal. And went out and found myself a new fridge, which was about the same size as the one that had died. And ended up with this brand new fridge. Plus $200 to replace some of the meat that we had lost in the process. So the old fridge goes to the dump. And I'm the happiest man in McDowell there for the next couple of weeks. In the insurance industry, they call that new for old replacement. And that's the sort of thing that Jesus is talking about here. Jesus said, I didn't come just to patch up an old system, which is past its use-by date. I've come to replace it with something which is brand new and far better. That's what I've come to do. The Pharisees, they thought that fasting and praying and observing Sabbaths and giving to the poor and following the letter of the Old Testament law, these were the ways that you met God's expectations and you satisfied God and you got his approval. You got to heaven by being a good person and doing lots and lots of good things. The disciples of John also had a very high view of the law of Moses and all the ceremonies that went with it. And yes, they were looking forward to the coming of the Messiah, but in the process of waiting for the Messiah to come, it was very important for them to remain very, very devout Jews. But what Jesus is telling them here is that it's just simply not possible to revamp the old religious rituals of the Jewish faith. There's no point in trying to mix his new ideas with the old ones. He had to replace them completely. He had to make a fresh start. The old dead religion, if you like, of works was being replaced with a whole new way of actually relating to God. This relationship that we can have with God through Jesus Christ is a means for great joy and freedom and liberty that God wants to give to those who are trusting in Jesus himself. One of the slight frustrations, I think, of reading these couple of verses here in Matthew 9 is that it doesn't tell us what the disciples of John actually thought about what Jesus said. Doesn't tell us whether they liked what he said. It doesn't tell us whether they really understood what Jesus was saying. It doesn't tell us whether they got real excited about it and maybe left John and came and followed after him. Would have been nice to know. But we're not told that. We're just left hanging. But what about us? This is where the rubber hits the road. And now I know that we're not Jews and probably we're not particularly troubled about the matter of fasting. That's unless we've signed up to Weight Watchers or one of those mobs. Right. But you know what? There are people that I know who think like the disciples of John the Baptist. I know they're not disciples of John the Baptist, but they think like the disciples of John the Baptist. They think that somehow or other Christianity is about keeping rules. Or they think that it's about, you know, ticking certain boxes and impressing God and maybe impressing our friends and doing so by living a fairly righteous, or I should say self-righteous, life. Well, what Jesus would say tonight to you, if that's the way that you think, is think again. Think again. Because you see, that sort of thinking, as far as Jesus is concerned, it went out 2,000 years ago. 2,000 years ago, Jesus introduced a whole new way by which we can have a relationship with God. 2,000 years ago, Jesus came and he set us free from a life of law-keeping. But there are still people today who keep wanting to gravitate back to impress God the way that the Pharisees are doing, the way that the disciples of John were doing. And yet Jesus is saying is that it is impossible to impress God by living like that. There's only one person who lived a life good enough to impress God, and that is Jesus himself. He's the only one. What did he do with that life? He gave it back to God by dying on a cross for sinners like us. That's what he did with that perfect life. He died in our place. And Jesus says to us tonight, friends, he says, I want you to look to me. I want you to trust in me. I died for you. I shed my blood for you. And the only way that God will accept you is if you put your trust in me. And when we do that, when we really mean that, when we put our trust in what Jesus has done for us on the cross, then we are acceptable to God. We are invited into his family. We can join, if you like, the family feast that is going on. The old system based on rules didn't work. It was broken. So Jesus came to replace it. And the system that he's introduced to replace that old system provides for forgiveness for the sinners of this world. It offers new life. Not just new life now, but life for eternity. He gives us the gift of the Spirit. It's no wonder that the disciples of Jesus were enjoying themselves. The Christian life, really, when you think about it, is far more a feast than it is a funeral. Christians should be the happiest people, the most joyful people around. Do you agree that? They should be. And I guess the only other question we have to ask ourselves as we get to the end of this passage tonight is, you know, have we joined the party? Are we celebrating like the disciples of Jesus were celebrating in his presence? Well, I don't want this to sound cheap, but you know, there's a real sense in which when you become a Christian, you experience the greatest joy and the greatest satisfaction, the greatest sort of sense of liberty and liberation, because, you see, that's the way it is meant to be in the Christian life. The Christian life should be anything but dull and